Another 1,000 times. Hold my hands tight. We'll make it another night. I still get a little scared of something new, but I feel a little safer when I'm with you. Falling doesn't feel so bad when I know you're falling this way too.
You're listening to Noise Theory on WRCT Pittsburgh. That song was called Devil Town by an artist called Cave Town. Before that, you heard Rumpus Room by Shoo Shoo and Liars. And coming up next, This Solemn Day by Iron and Wine.
This solemn day. DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
All right, let's start with some big but expected news. So I don't have that much more to say about it than I've already said, because this is exactly what we've been expecting. Joe Biden's voting rights bill seems to be dead because Democrats have been unable to change the filibuster, which very clearly became a prerequisite to really be able to do the voting rights bill. And this is exactly what we expected. So I don't know how much there is to say. But as the Associated Press is reporting, voting bill collapses, Democrats unable to change filibuster. Voting legislation that Democrats and civil rights leaders say is vital to protecting democracy. That's true. It is. Collapsed when two senators refused to join their own party in changing Senate rules to overcome a Republican filibuster after a raw emotional debate. Who are those two senators? Well, I'm sure many of you know they are Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema. The outcome Wednesday night, says the AP, was a stinging defeat for President Biden and his party, coming at the tumultuous close to his first year in office. Yeah, almost to the day. Biden said in a statement after the vote, "I am profoundly disappointed," but that he is, quote, "not deterred," and vowed to, quote, "explore every measure and use every tool at our disposal to stand up for democracy." So the question now is, what can be done via executive order to maybe put in place some elements of what would have been in the voting rights bill? But Manchin and Sinema's positions on this, not a surprise. And the idea of changing the filibuster, remember, was to reduce the threshold for debating the voting rights bill from 60. When you have 50 Democrats and you need 60 votes, you need 10 Republicans. This is pretty simple math. The idea of changing the filibuster was to change the requirement of 60. In order to do that, they needed all 50 Democrats. They didn't have them. The filibuster doesn't change. And thus, there is at this time no path forward for the voting rights legislation. Now, I think it's important that, you know, when we talked about leading into the 2016 election, there were these people who should be really crawling into a hole and never being heard from again in terms of their opinions, who were saying Hillary, Trump, it's not really going to make a difference. It's all kind of the same. If it's not a real progressive, I don't want the person. It doesn't really matter. And we said, well, but sir, ma'am, what about the Supreme Court? What about all these different things? Look at the Supreme Court at this point in time. Look at all the things. Look at the disasters that ended up happening under Donald Trump. So we've got to remember that. At the same time, we have to remember now that this is a fundamental building block of our democracy. Republicans have made it clear they've abandoned policy. They've abandoned convincing people that their ideas are good. They merely want to win on obstructing Democrats and using voter suppression and various other tactics to make it more difficult to vote, to try to win elections. And then if you don't win, try to steal the election. That's what they do now. And so when something like this gets stalled in its tracks, hopefully Joe Biden can do some of this via executive order. We don't yet know. We have to see. But remember these kind of turning points. And one of those was Hillary, Trump. How bad could Trump really be? Let's send a message. Let's shake it up. Wow, what a disastrous 4 years. We've got to be thinking along those same lines here. This next story is, it's unbelievable, and yet it's predictable because it's Florida. Florida has suspended a public health official, a doctor, for encouraging his own staff to get vaccinated. It's insane and it's dystopian. NPR reports, Florida Department of Health confirms Dr. Raul Pino put on leave for encouraging Orange County Department of Health employees to get vaccinated. Didn't require anybody to get vaccinated, encouraged people to get vaccinated, and he has been suspended. The Florida Department of Health medical director that oversees areas of Orange County, including Orlando, has been put on leave for encouraging his own staff to get vaccinated. Orange County medical director Dr. Raul Pino wrote an email to staff on January 4th, encouraging them to get vaccinated and boosted for COVID. In it, he wrote, quote, "I'm having a hard time understanding how we can be in public health and not practice it. Makes perfect sense. Sensible, down-to-earth statement." After sending the email, he was placed on administrative leave. In an email to WMFE, Florida Department of Health confirmed he was on leave because, quote, "The decision to get vaccinated is a personal choice that should be free from coercion and mandates from employers." Now, encouraging is not demanding. It is not coercion. It is not a mandate. It is not offering a consequence if you fail to do it. It's just, hey, you know, like, we're in public health and there's these vaccines and they're very good at keeping people alive when they get COVID, and we should really get them. It's kind of weird that we work in public health and people need to be free from mandates. Also dystopian, Florida Department of Health says it's even conducting an inquiry into whether any laws were broken by sending the email. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has banned vaccine mandates in the workplace, and the state has seen a surge in Omicron cases. What? And also remember that before it became politically inconvenient to Ron DeSantis, Ron DeSantis was encouraging vaccination. More recently, DeSantis was asked if he's boosted, and he didn't even want to answer the question. And the encouragement of vaccination has stopped. But when it was a different political situation, when it was Trump made the vaccines and let's go get them, Ron DeSantis had a very different outlook. And at the end of the day, Ron DeSantis is determined to spread COVID as far and wide as possible into the nooks and crannies of the state of Florida. If saying, hey, guys, since we practice public health, we should actually practice it and get vaccinated. No mandate, no coercion, no threat of firing, but we should probably do it. That now is not allowed de facto because he was placed on administrative leave. What's going to be next? You go to the pharmacy. Hey, by the way, you're picking up your pills. Did you know that we have vaccines available and they're free to you? Did you want to get one? Have you been vaccinated? Whoa, that's coercion. Pharmacists shouldn't even be allowed to do that. That's the next step. When you say this action by Dr. Raul Pino deserves a suspension, which, of course, it doesn't. And we'll see whether he is ultimately fired, whether he comes back with some kind of reprimand, whether he quits or whatever the case may be. All right. Thirdly today, this is also big news. We have a horrible Supreme Court right now. That shouldn't be news, but we do. Thanks, by the way, to Donald Trump choosing three people who are now on it rather than Hillary Clinton. That cannot be ignored. That's a reality. But that disastrous Supreme Court has put a final stop to Donald Trump's demands that White House records not be provided to the committee investigating the Trump riots. This is good news. CNBC reporting, the Supreme Court has rejected a Trump request to block the release of records to the January 6th committee. The Supreme Court rejected a request from former President Trump to block those records. The ruling, which Trump cannot appeal, sets the stage for more than 700 pages of Trump White House records to soon be sent by the National Archives to the committee. That's an important detail. It is not now Trump who has to release them. It is the National Archives that will release them. Trump had argued that he had the authority as a former president to invoke executive privilege to prevent the disclosure of the records. President Biden has declined to invoke executive privilege for the records, which the committee wants as part of its probe of the invasion of the Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters. This is a very, very good decision, and it is the correct decision. Notably, the Supreme Court order, the Supreme Court decision, was 8-1. The one was Justice Clarence Thomas, who dissented and said, now Trump should be able to block it. And what is particularly disturbing about that is that Clarence Thomas's wife cheered the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th that ultimately was one of the primary inciting factors of those Trump riots. And she subsequently apologized to her husband's law clerks. But given Clarence Thomas's obvious conflict of interest here, if he had respect for the law, he would recuse himself from anything even remotely related to the January 6th Trump riots. But it is Clarence Thomas after all. And imagine, I mean, just Think about that. The wife of a Supreme Court justice was cheering the event and the individuals that led to an attempted insurrection at the country, in the country, where your husband is a Supreme Court justice. It's absolutely stunning stuff. But Ginni Thomas is maybe something to focus on a different day. That's the Supreme Court decision. This appears to be the end. I know we say that all the time with Trump and trying to hide records. Well, this is it now. And then something else happens. By every reasonable stretch of the imagination, this is a Supreme Court decision and this is it. And the records will be provided to the committee. Whether they will be made public deliberately or because they will leak or whatever, we do not yet know. But that's the Supreme Court decision, and it is the correct decision. Let me know what you think. Will we ever see those records? You can find me on Twitter at dpacman. We're going to take a very quick break and be right back. So the David Pakman Show subreddit has really been on fire. I think we have close to 34,000 of our viewers and listeners subscribed. You can find it at davidpakman.com/reddit, and many interesting discussions happening every day, a few of which I spotted this morning that I wanted to highlight. User Stone500 posted, "My kid's school district in Missouri is closed for the rest of this week due to staffing and attendance issues. I got a letter from the school system. Essentially, there's so many people sick that the school had to close." And this is a really important thing. I know people in these situations as well, where the school is open in principle, but then so many teachers are sick that the school is closed until they can find teachers or teachers can recover from COVID. Even when we have this discussion of should schools be closed or not because of the virus, my preference is for schools to be open. I agree with everybody who says it's better for kids to be in school in person. Who would deny that? The question is, by forcing them open, do you really keep them open? Because if they're open and 15% of the teachers end up having to isolate/quarantine because they're either exposed or catch COVID, and then you just don't have people, you don't have staff, you don't have janitors, whatever, and then you close anyway, what did we really gain by having a couple of chaotic days in school? And I'm hearing from tons of parents who are saying that this exact thing is going on. When people started going back 2 weeks ago, 1 week ago, my thought was, there's no way that this is going to work in any real way. Either you're just going to commit to the schools becoming super spreader nodes, or you'll be open a few days. And if you're actually testing and have some kind of protocol, you'll then just be forced to close. And it's happening just about everywhere. So interesting that a lot of parents in the audience are experiencing that. And again, I think it's better for the schools to be open. We want them open. It seems like it might have made sense to do remote maybe 2-3 weeks. We see the Omicron wave already coming down. And we'll have those numbers for you probably early next week. The numbers are looking better and better. It probably made sense to just do remote for a couple of weeks. Doesn't sound completely crazy or devastating to the students. And it would have prevented this insanity that's going on now. A really very important post from SW Frame, who said, "Should the Democrats try to get a la carte network TV in order to reduce the impact of Fox News?" Fox News is not ad supported, not completely. That's true. They charge the cable networks more than other channels, which means all subscribers indirectly fund the disinformation spewing out of Fox News. Maybe Democrats should get the cable networks to switch to a la carte programs. I have been talking about this for years. A ton of these networks function, are viable channels through bundling. And or through charging really high fees. So when you pay $100 for cable, you may or may not know that certain amounts from that $100 go to specific channels or groups of channels. Do you really think that I'm making this up now? OK, but do you really think that imagine that there was a bundle that's like Golf 1, 2 and 3, HGTV 1 through 4. And we, you know, whatever. I don't even know if these channels exist. Imagine that it's like, OK, you got to pay us $7 per subscriber for all 7 of those channels. Imagine that those were separated out and instead you could pay $1 for each of those channels. Do you think that many people are going to say, I want to pay for HGTV 1, 2, 3 and 4? Of course not. Of course not. And much the same way, if Fox News had a different deal where people could say, I don't want Fox News, and then they can save $3, $4, $5. I don't know what it is. Fox News loses a ton of money, and that's exactly why they don't do it that way. So, yes, a la carte cable programming is something I've been talking about for a really long time. It's there with HBO. We know the technology exists. If you don't want HBO, you don't pay for HBO. It's very, very simple. Considered a premium channel. If it were, quite frankly, if it were that way for a lot more channels, all of us would be saving money and a lot of these channels would go out of business. But yes, that's a very, very good idea. Lastly, a user, Brian CRC, posted question for Trump rally attendees. The Trump rally started up again over the weekend. Can you name something new you learned for the rally? And of course, the answer is no. Trump has been doing the same stuff at the rallies basically since Election Day, right? Saying I won and information's coming out very soon. And the real insurrection was January. It was not January. It was November of 2020 and all of this different stuff. They are not there to learn anything new. They are there to participate in the cult of personality. And unless we understand that, it's going to be very difficult to prevent it from happening again. And it is not about what he says. It is not about learning anything. We need to understand these people really for what they are, which is, quite frankly, cult members of a different sort, a political cult. And I think that would be a really interesting question. We've seen people do interviews of Trump supporters at the rallies. It would be great if someone on the way out stopped people and said, what did you learn today that you didn't know before? That would be a treasure trove of fascinating interview material. I encourage someone to do it. I don't want to be caught dead near any of those rallies, particularly because it seems really difficult to leave. There was video from the rally in Florence, Arizona over the weekend of people saying, we're not being allowed to leave. They're saying you need to wait until the full Trump motorcade leaves. And then they were allegedly letting all the vendors leave. And there were people stuck for hours after the rally. Imagine Trump's late to every rally, drones on for 90 to 120 minutes. And then you're not even allowed to leave right away. Insane. I don't want to go. If someone else wants to go and ask these people what they've learned, I totally support it. But I have no interest in being there. Join the discussion at davidpakman.com/Reddit. All right. I do have another story today of another one of these anti-vax unvaccinated people that has died of COVID. But this one is particularly insidious because of the details. This is someone who wanted to get infected. They wanted the immunity that they believed getting infected with the virus would give them. And they are now dead. Hannah Horka, a Czech singer, is dead after intentionally getting infected with COVID. The BBC by Ben Tobias reporting on this. A folk singer from the Czech Republic has died after deliberately catching COVID. Hannah Horka was 57 years old, was unvaccinated, posted on social media that she was recovering after testing positive, and was dead 2 days later. Her son said she got infected on purpose when he and his father had the virus so she could get a recovery pass to access certain venues. The Czech Republic reported a record number of COVID cases yesterday. Mr. Rek and his father, who were both fully vaccinated, both caught COVID over Christmas, but he said his mother decided not to stay away from them, preferring instead to expose herself. He said she should have isolated for a week because we tested positive, but she was with us the whole time. Proof of vaccination or recent infection from the virus is required in the Czech Republic to go to many venues, including movie theaters, bars and cafes. His mother was a member of one of the oldest Czech folk groups, Asonance. She had wanted to catch COVID so there would be fewer restrictions on her. 2 days before she died, she wrote on social media she was recovering. Quote, now there will be a theater, sauna, a concert. Sunday morning, the day she died, she said she was feeling better and got dressed to go for a walk. Her back started hurting. She went to lie down in her bedroom. Her son says in 10 minutes, it was all over. She choked to death. Although she was unvaccinated, Jan, her son, stressed his mother didn't believe in some of the more bizarre conspiracy theories about COVID vaccines. Her philosophy was she was more okay with the idea of catching it than getting vaccinated. Not that we would get microchipped or anything like that. There was no point in trying to discuss the issue with her, as it would get too emotional. Instead, he hoped that by telling his story, he could convince others to get vaccinated. That's the hope. How scary is it that she felt good enough to go for a walk and 10 minutes later was dead? That is absolutely horrifying. And we talk about sympathy. You know, every one of these situations is different. But this is someone who not only refused to get vaccinated, but deliberately got sick. She deliberately exposed herself to the virus, refused the best protection we have against serious illness and death when we have a highly effective and protective vaccine. Where is this on the spectrum of sympathy? I don't know. And there's a case to be made that big picture, the recovery passes are kind of a silly idea. Now, if you test positive in another country and you can't get back to the U.S., and because you've tested positive, testing may not be accurate for a long period of time. In that situation, it makes sense to say, I believe this individual has recovered. They should be allowed to go back to the U.S. That makes sense to me. If you have as a policy to come to indoor restaurants, you got to be vaccinated, or to go to movie theaters, you've got to be vaccinated. Vaccinated or recovery certificate doesn't seem like a very good idea, particularly since we don't really know that much, particularly in the context of Omicron. For how long are you protected after recovery? We just don't know the answers to those questions. It seems problematic to me. And so, you know, her whole goal here was, let me get sick to get better, to be recovered, to then be able to go places without being vaccinated. Even the pretext of that, even that as a pretext, does not seem logical to me. But another tragic story, unvaccinated person says, I'm going to go and get myself sick in order to recover and have immunity. It didn't work. She is dead. And we will have more on this on our Instagram. You can find that at David Pakman Show on Instagram. You can also find me there at David.Pakman. It's great to have back on the program today Vincent Racaniello, who's a virology professor at Columbia University and also host of This Week in Virology. Great to have you back. I really appreciate it.
Oh, great to be here.
So, I guess we have to start with Omicron. And if whatever prediction you want on Omicron, you can find it, which is this is the beginning of something that's going to get much worse. This is the beginning of the end of the pandemic and everything in between. What do we know now about the level of transmissibility of Omicron in terms of its R value, as well as how much more or less likely it is to cause hospitalization?
So determining transmissibility is very difficult. So getting an R value, especially this far into an epidemic, is very hard. But I like to look at what we call secondary attack rates, which are calculated in closed situation, like a household.
Yes.
Where you can know that this person was infected, and then within a certain amount of time, these other people got infected. And it's not easy to do that. But recently, a preprint came out of Denmark where they did it. And the beauty of the study was it was just when they were transitioning from Delta to Omicron. So you had households that were either an Omicron household or a Delta household. It was
right. Perfect.
And they had good numbers, and they have a terrific medical records registry there so they could get all the information. And what was very clear is that Omicron has a higher secondary attack rate than Delta. So it's transmitting better in the household situation. But that appears to be entirely due to the fact that Omicron is evading antibodies, because as you know, it has many changes in the spike protein, more than any other variant. And if you take sera from people who have been vaccinated or recovered from infection, it doesn't block infection with Omicron as well as, say, with Delta. And so the Danish scientists concluded that this increased ability of Omicron to transmit, say, within households is entirely due to immune evasion and not to an inherent increased transmissibility of the virus. So we imagine that there are some properties of viruses that can make them transmit better. Maybe they reproduce better. They're more stable in droplets that come out of your respiratory tract. But that's not the case with Omicron. It really is evading antibodies, and that's why it's spreading. Now, the other part of your question, how about disease, right? Now, with first reports out of South Africa suggested it might be milder. And people started to call it an Omicold, which is not really right. My colleague Daniel Griffin, an infectious disease doctor, says that's not right because he's seen plenty of very sick people infected with Omicron, and especially unvaccinated people. So in the unvaccinated, Omicron can be just as severe as Delta and previous variants. But the South African study was kind of complicated because a lot of the people in their study were vaccinated, and a lot of them were younger, and a lot of them didn't have comorbidities. And so that all biases it to be milder. So, you know, making conclusions very quickly about how severe infections are is very difficult. So I would say at this point, we know that Omicron can evade immunity, and that's why it moves through a population well. It can infect vaccinated people, just like Delta could. But in a vaccinated person, the disease is much milder than in an unvaccinated person.
With there's so many things that we could go off to the from there, just a couple. So if we look at the UK as an example, a layperson might look at cases and deaths. And of course, at this point, we know that not nearly all of the infections are being captured as a case, which depends on a test. But putting that aside for a moment, it looked like during the Omicron wave, cases went up about 6x in the UK. Known cases, whereas deaths went up somewhere between 80 and 100% or so. When you see that, it suggests that it is in some way less likely to kill people. And that's UK, not South Africa. But are those two numbers alone not enough to really tell us that?
Well, the problem is that a lot of the people are vaccinated. And if you stratify the data, vaccinated versus unvaccinated, make sure you control for age and comorbidities, which is not easy to do.
True.
Then you find that it's milder in vaccinated people, but so is Delta. And so are all the other variants. But the fact is that vaccination works. It prevents you from getting severe disease. And now part of the issue is with Omicron, it came at about the holiday season, right? When everyone is traveling and getting together. Plus we are now getting together way more than we ever did since the beginning of the pandemic because people are starting to relax. And all of this contributes. So, you know, movement of a virus has many factors around it, not just the virus, not just your immunity, but how people behave as well.
The wastewater data in some cities in the United States is showing just dramatic reductions in the amount of virus during this Omicron wave. I think when I looked 10 days ago or so, or maybe a week ago, at Boston wastewater data, it was down about 2/3, even though cases are only down about 10%, which you know, you would imagine that would be cases would be a lagging indicator to the wastewater. How important is the wastewater data?
I'm not sure you can quantify anything. All you can say is we have this virus here now. So there may be a period where you don't see a virus in wastewater or the levels are very low, and then suddenly you get more positives. So that can inform you of an impending epidemic. But I would not make much of the levels because, you know, this is incidental virus that you're swallowing. It's passing out of your gastrointestinal tract and going into the sewers. So it's not really part of the infection process. So to ascribe any meaning to how much is there, remember, we're doing PCR to measure viral RNA in the water. And as a recent study out of Switzerland just showed, there is very little correlation between PCR levels and infectious virus. So I think you have to realize the limitations of looking at virus RNA in wastewater.
That's fair. Last time you were on, we talked a little bit about the very top level understanding that we have about viruses over time becoming less deadly. And you gave us many caveats when we talked about that, but it was this sort of general idea. In the last few weeks, as the conversation about what happens after Omicron has become a more and more relevant conversation, there have been a bunch of different articles coming out claiming to debunk that idea as a general principle, that really viruses become more chaotic, and that that could get you milder disease, but it might not, and that there are counterexamples from history. Can we now, because it seems more relevant than ever, talk a little more specifically about this idea of what is likely to come next after Omicron?
So the idea, which we talked about last time, you know, it's a human idea that viruses over time tend to get less virulent. But we're talking about long, long periods of time. We're not talking about 2 years here.
Ah.
So, for example, if a virus spilled, and remember, all human viruses came from some other animal at some point in time, let's say thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago. Measles virus 15,000 years ago spilled over into people from cows, right? And so initially, it's probably quite lethal because it's a new host. We have no immunity to the virus, and it does what SARS-CoV-2 does. But over time, population immunity grows, and that helps you have a milder disease when you get infected. Now, there's also this hypothesis that maybe the virus changes over time because there's no point in killing your host or making your host very sick. So random changes in the genome that reduce virulence may persist. But I have to say, you know, with the one exception that we might have talked about last time, using viruses to kill rabbits in Australia, there's no other evidence that viruses tend to get less virulent over time in their hosts. It's just an appealing hypothesis. So the Australian situation, they had brought in rabbits in the 1800s for hunting purposes. They multiplied like crazy. There were too many of them. So they introduced a virus to try and kill them. And in the first year, 99% of the rabbits were killed. But then those 1% that survived were more resistant to the virus. And then the virus changed to be less virulent as well. So it's actually a beautiful experiment that's consistent with this idea. But I must say, there's no other evidence for it. And as you mentioned, as soon as Omicron came out, we had these data from South Africa. People were saying, oh, it's getting less virulent. But I think it's far too premature to say that, because as we've already talked about, there are lots of confounding factors there.
So what does that do for the conversation about what is next and whether we are months from shifting from the pandemic to the endemic phase of this? Is it can we really say anything about that at this point?
Well, from the start, we have thought that as population immunity grew to this virus, we would have less and less severe disease. And we see that in vaccinated people. It supports that. Even though we have many variants emerging that can evade immunity to a certain extent, the vaccines still work. They protect you from severe disease and hospitalization, really in the 90% still. So, and we know from other coronaviruses, the common cold coronaviruses that infect all of us every year, that widespread population immunity probably associates with milder disease. And so that, from the very start, led to this idea that over time, as more of the world became immune to SARS-CoV-2, we would have less and less severe disease. The virus would not necessarily be changing with respect to virulence, but simply population immunity would do that. I really think that's what's going to happen, because we see the vaccines working really well despite the antigenic evolution of the virus. So I've always thought, and this was actually an idea influenced by Ralph Baric, who was a coronavirologist for many years. He said, this will probably be a common cold coronavirus. Who knows how long it will take? And at that point, we might not need to vaccinate it against it any longer.
We're not at that point yet, though.
I don't think we are, because, you know, most of the world is still not fully vaccinated.
Right.
Right. There are some countries that have very high rates of vaccination and they have much less disease as a consequence. But there are other countries like Africa, which are barely vaccinated. So we can't hope to end a pandemic until we get either a lot of people infected or vaccinated. I mean, that's what's going to happen now over the next few years. You're going to either get vaccinated or you're going to get infected. And in both cases, you're going to get some kind of immunity.
There are a few countries, at least a couple, the UK, Australia, that are pretty quickly going in a direction of saying, We believe we are functioning as though we are in the endemic phase. Mm-hmm. We are going to start removing restrictions and kind of putting this at the individual level to say, if I have a particular reason that I need to go beyond what's required of me by the state, I'm going to do it based on my level of risk. Does that make any sense to you at this point in time?
It does. And I've been thinking about this for now many weeks because it's very clear we have multiple vaccines that work. They don't prevent infection, which is normal, but they do prevent severe disease. And so in many countries like the UK and Israel and the US, where we have plenty of vaccine, we now have vaccines that can control severe disease. People who have decided not to be vaccinated have made their choice. So I think the rest of the population can now start to move on. The only problem with that idea is that if too many unvaccinated people get infected, as you know, the healthcare system gets overburdened.
Yes.
And that is a problem because they have other issues to deal with. They have other health problems and patients to deal with. So we don't want hospitals full of unvaccinated, severely ill COVID patients. That's why I think in many places in the U.S., we're still masking. Even though we're all fully vaccinated, many of us are fully vaccinated, there's no risk to us anymore of getting severely ill. We are protecting the unvaccinated.
The biggest and most regular pushback that I hear when anybody says what you just said is, but hold on a second. Even the people doing everything correctly, getting their three doses and, mm-hmm. and et cetera, they are still at greater risk due to the unvaccinated because of the ability to spread the disease. The counter that's increasingly being placed mm-hmm. upon us is, well, hold on a second. With Omicron, it's not clear that the vaccines prevent transmission. They prevent death. They prevent serious illness. But do they really prevent transmission? So it's really a two-part question. What about the people saying, even those who did the right things, we are still at risk because of everybody else? And number two, what do we know about the effect of the vaccine on transmission right now?
So I feel I am not at risk from an unvaccinated person.
Okay.
Because I'm triple vaccinated. And if I get infected, which I likely will, I will have a mild disease, right? There's a very good chance I have a mild disease. Most of the severe disease in vaccinated people, you know, that 10% or so that don't, are in people with comorbidities. Either
yes.
they're older or they're obese. That's a big one, or diabetic or asthmatic. Those are the people who are most likely to have severe disease, even if fully vaccinated. Of course, we don't want to forget the kids under 5 who can't be vaccinated yet. We still have to be careful about them. So I don't view vaccinated people as the ones at risk. It's the unvaccinated people, and they're the ones that are going to cause problems in the healthcare system. Now, with respect to transmission, there was a wonderful preprint out of Switzerland last week, and this complements other work that's come out as well, which clearly shows that. Well, first of all, you can't measure transmission by doing PCR. That is very clear. And almost every study that has looked at shedding of a vaccinated person is wrong because they're measuring PCR, and that does not correlate with infectious virus shedding. In the Swiss study, they showed that a vaccinated person not only sheds less infectious virus than an unvaccinated person, but does so for fewer days after being infected.
Okay.
And so that has significant implications. So vaccination doesn't abolish shedding. It doesn't abolish transmission, but it knocks it so far down that it no longer plays a role in driving the epidemic. That's how
That seems to then support those who say, I'm vaccinated, but the unvaccinated are putting me at risk. I know statistically you still won't be seriously ill, but a lot of people have comorbidities in this country. It sounds like mm-hmm. it's not wrong to say, even as a vaccinated person, the unvaccinated do put me at greater risk.
No, the unvaccinated do not, because you are not going to get sick, right, if you're fully vaccinated. The likelihood you're going to get severely ill is very low.
Oh, I see. So it's both. Right? It's both that. By being unvaccinated, you are shedding more virus.
Oh,
but
yes.
By being vaccinated, you also are less likely to actually get sick.
Exactly.
Okay,
and you are less likely to pass it on to someone else as well. So the more people we have vaccinated, the more likely we can stop the transmission.
We are going to link to that preprint from Switzerland. It sounds like there's really a wealth of data there. We've been speaking with Vincent Racaniello, virology professor at Columbia University, and make sure to check out This Week in Virology. Always great having you on.
Thank you for having me, David. Appreciate it.
So yesterday, President Joe Biden held his first what's called a formal press conference in several months. And I'm not going to go through each piece of it because, quite frankly, most of it wasn't very interesting. I do think the incredible double standard applied by many right wingers on these press conferences should be mentioned, which is for months and months they were saying, where's Biden? No formal press conference. He did one yesterday. The press wouldn't stop asking questions. And so Biden kept going and going for nearly 2 hours. And then they said he was droning on. It was a marathon press conference, nearly 2 hours. He talked way too long. Guys, you can't have it both ways. But the piece that I want to focus on, and I apologize in advance for those who saw this yesterday and have already suffered brain damage from seeing it. I'm going to play for you maybe the dumbest question I have heard in the history of journalism. And I know that that says a lot. Certainly, this is the dumbest question asked of Joe Biden during his presidency. The person asking the question is Fox News reporter Peter Doocy. Peter Doocy is always trying to get gotchas and so on and so forth. Joe Biden knows this, and yet he calls on him basically every time. I only remember a few instances like this specifically, where Joe Biden has called on Peter Doocy every single time, doesn't shy away from his questions. Listen to the question that Peter Doocy asked.
Why are you trying so hard in your first year to pull the country so far to the left?
All right, let's let Joe Biden first start to answer it. Then I have a lot to say about this.
Well, I'm not. I don't know what you consider to be too far to the left. If, in fact, we're talking about making sure that we had the money for COVID, making sure we had the money to put together the bipartisan infrastructure, making sure we were able to provide for those things that, in fact, would significantly reduce the burden on working class people, but make them, they have to continue to work hard. I don't know how that is pointed to the left. If you may recall.
So, OK, so Joe Biden has an answer for it. The reason that this question is so dumb is because the narrative around Biden's extreme leftism is so untrue that the left wishes this was the case. Like, I wish Joe Biden was doing more left wing stuff. Think about Biden's major actions during his first year as president. And this is not like a report card. It's just evaluating whether the things he did are really left or not. He did COVID stimulus. Now, Trump did two of them. Biden's COVID stimulus is no further left than Trump's two COVID stimuli. Biden did one, Trump did two. So that's a major accomplishment. He did it relatively quickly once getting in office, not very far left. Number two, the vaccine rollout has been one of Joe Biden's kind of major actions or programs during his first year. If you believe Trump made the vaccines, which he didn't, but let's imagine that we kind of accept this right wing story that Trump made the vaccines. How is distributing the vaccines that your Republican hero made far left? So that's not far left. Joe Biden got a very modest infrastructure bill passed. And remember that for a very long time, Republicans liked infrastructure spending to some degree. And there's nothing particularly far left about it. You know, centrist governments around the world do infrastructure. Right wing governments around the world do infrastructure. Left wing governments around the world do infrastructure. It's a very modest infrastructure bill, quite milquetoast, if I say so myself. Getting out of Afghanistan is a major first year Biden accomplishment. That was a Trump plan. So how is Biden doing the thing that Trump promised to do? Far left, not seeing anything that matches that description. These are the major Biden accomplishments during year one. Now just rolling out, sending four free COVID tests to anybody who asks for them. But you've got to ask for them. there is nothing very far left here. And a lot of this is, so there's really two stories here. One story is the false narrative about Biden being an extreme leftist. I think that Biden ran on a policy that's like marginally to the left of Barack Obama. And certainly the implementation has been extraordinarily center left. Nothing remarkable at all. And then it's just this pathetic and flaccid continued attempt from Peter Ducey to make himself seem alpha, for lack of a better term, and do a big boy for the Fox News audience, which I think is kind of working for him. Like, I think if the Fox audience sees, why are you trying to move the country so far to the left? They probably do believe that that's what Joe Biden is trying to do, even though it could not be further from the truth. I am having a hard time. And I know Newsmax and OAN sometimes ask questions of presidents. This seems like the dumbest question posed to a president in a very, very long time. The other part I want to talk about of Joe Biden's press conference yesterday. Remember, Joe Biden criticized by the right for not doing a press conference for a while. Did one yesterday and took questions for nearly 2 hours. And some right wingers were saying he went on too long. The Drudge Report had a splash headline about marathon press conference. He doesn't do one and you criticize him. And then he answers too many questions and then you criticize. Give me a break, guys. One person who was extraordinarily triggered by Joe Biden's press conference yesterday, and I think it's both what was in the press conference and the fact that it's Joe Biden doing a press conference rather than him, is Donald Trump. Donald Trump putting out a statement yesterday through his Save America thing. And what he said was, how come Biden picks a reporter off a list, in all cases softball questions, and then reads the answer? I would never have been allowed to get away with that, nor would I have to. Then Donald Trump appearing with Fox News host and a radio host. I don't remember if it's Westwood One or where Mark Levin hosts his show. Right wing host Mark Levin. And Trump is just completely triggered by the fact that people paid attention to Joe Biden. Let's take a listen.
I noticed a lot of things. I noticed things that are affecting the American people directly. He thinks things are going pretty swimmingly. They didn't talk about crime. They didn't talk about what's going on in the classrooms. They didn't talk about what's happening at the border. And he was there for almost 2 hours, and none of that came up. Don't you find that remarkable?
Well, crime is so bad. It's so out of control. When you look at these kids being shoved off subway stations in New York, off platforms, right into a train.
Now, that's horrible. What on earth does that have to do with Joe Biden? That it's we're talking about NYPD. Like, what they, on the one hand, they say, let states and municipalities do what's right for them. But it's Joe Biden's fault that something is happening on the subways of New York. It's tragic. But what does it have to do with Joe Biden?
In full speed, and a young woman's thrown right into the train, right into the face.
So as you can hear, by the way, this is downer Trump right now. Very, very down, low energy.
The train killed instantly. And then you look at what happened with the young lady selling in a furniture store, selling furniture, and somebody walks in and knifes her to death.
Horrible.
And nothing happens to these people. Nothing happens.
And the other question here, of course, when we talk about violence in cities, is they talk about dangerous democratic run cities. As many of you know, because I've done this so many times, most cities are run by Democrats because more Democrats want to live in cities and Republicans tend to live more rurally. So really safe cities are run by Democrats and higher crime cities are run by Democrats because cities tend to be run by Democrats. OK, let's continue. Trump angry with the reporters during the press conference.
A commander in chief saying that he expects Russia to invade Ukraine. Now, don't you think Vladimir Putin heard that, too?
Well, yeah. And it was like, the problem is, it was like nothing's going to be done. You know, in other words, I expect him. Now, maybe it was a mistake because it was said in the middle of another sentence and another thought. But he said, use the words, expects that he's going in. And I thought that was strange. Mm-hmm. Whether you don't want it to happen, or did, you know, I just thought it was a very strange thought to be putting out there that he expects.
What great analysis from Trump, huh?
Expects him to go in. And nobody seems to pick it up because the reporters are the most friendly group of reporters I've ever seen. They don't even ask questions. They make positive statements and then sit down.
You know, I really didn't see it that way. I have been endlessly critical of the press corps when Trump was president and when Biden is president. I think there are often things managed by the press corps in ways that I think don't really make sense. But that was not what took place yesterday. There were real questions asked of Joe Biden. Biden sometimes didn't even answer them. Biden was asked straight up what happened to canceling 10 grand in student debt. He literally never answered the question. He walked off, wasn't pressed on it. So I have my criticisms of Biden, of report, but it was not a friendly press conference in the way Trump is describing here whatsoever. Here's more of Trump on the press conference.
Patriots, it's a great honor to have with us.
This is from the start of the interview.
President Donald Trump. President Trump, how are you, sir?
Sir.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great. President Trump,
good.
I imagine you saw most of this press conference. No, I did. And Joe Biden said he's had enormous progress during his presidency. I don't see it that way. Do you?
Well, progress in destroying our country, yes. I think that's been tremendous. He also said something that I assume was a mistake, but he said he expects Putin to go in. He said, I expect him to go in, to go into Ukraine. And I thought that was a very unusual answer. I don't know if he knew what he was saying, because it was, he said that as part of another question, and he was a little confused because he tried to correct something.
Yeah, that's part of the Biden dementia narrative, which Trump continues to push. And then, of course, at some point, it must be mentioned that Joe Biden is pushing us towards communism. And that did come up, of course, as absurd as it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Biden says he's not moved to the left. Peter Doocy said to him, why are you trying to take the country to the left? He says, I'm a moderate. I'm not a socialist. I'm not Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
I think his actions defy that, don't they?
Well, he says all that. He said that during the debates. He said that during his debates with other Democrats.
And of course, it's true. Joe Biden has not moved us towards socialism or communism. And I would encourage anybody who believes that he has to explain exactly which policies have done so.
But it's not true. And you know what he said on energy? You look at what he said on energy. Look at what you take a look at religion. What's going on there?
Nothing.
What the stances that these Democrats.
I mean, quite literally, nothing is going on.
Radical left Democrats are taking. No, he said all of these things that were very moderate, and then he did things that nobody could believe. Bernie Sanders cannot believe what's happening.
He said, "Yes, Bernie is like, oh my God." Joe, you're so far left, I can't believe it.
I would have never gotten away with any of this stuff. It's not really even believable, Mark, what's happening to me.
So Trump audibly confused. And again, look at Biden's actions. Tell me which ones are the socialist communist ones. He did COVID stimulus, but Trump did two of them. He rolled out the vaccine that Republicans believe Trump made. That's not very far left. He passed a very modest infrastructure bill. And he got out of Afghanistan, which was Trump's plan. So if anytime anybody says to you, remember when Jesse Lee Peterson interviewed me in L.A. When Obama was president, Trump was president, but it was about what Barack Obama did. He said Obama was a socialist. And I was like, well, what did he do? And he's like, well, he gave some people cell phones. That was Jesse Lee Peterson's explanation. So when people say Biden is going socialist communist, ask specifically which policies are the socialistic communistic policies. I'm curious to see what people tell you. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192 David P. Here's a voicemail I received with a very practical question about if it came time to leave the country, would you still be able to leave the country? It's a very good question.
Hi, David. I just heard you say on the stream that if the United States becomes a full-blown dictatorship by 2024.
Yeah.
You will be leaving the country. So I've been thinking about this a lot myself. And is it too late? If you wait until it's a full-blown dictatorship, will you even be able to leave the country? If you're that concerned about it happening, should you be making plans to leave before it goes full-blown dictatorship?
Yeah, this is a fair question, which is like, if things completely changed overnight in the U.S., and all of a sudden no one was allowed to leave, the plan of saying, I will stay if and until it gets really bad, doesn't work, because if it got so bad, you wouldn't be allowed to leave. I don't, you know, when we talk about the Canadian political scientist who said the U.S. could be a dictatorship by 2030 or whatever else the case may be, I believe that it would be a continued slow slide in that direction. And I am counting on the belief that I would have time to get out if such a time came. Now, would I, if it's so slow that the frog doesn't realize it's getting burned, right? Would I know when it's time to leave? These are all fair questions, but I don't think it would be like an overnight, no more flights out. I just don't think that that's the case. But maybe some people in the audience have a different perspective. On the bonus show today, we will talk about the 5G airline kerfuffle that's going on. We'll explain it and talk about what's going on. New Mexico has an interesting approach to all of the teachers out sick with Omicron. They're bringing in the National Guard to teach. Very interesting. And a Louisiana Senate candidate has gone viral for smoking cannabis in a campaign ad. We will tell you who it is and why he did it and what the effect is going to be on the campaign. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get instant access.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT. In sound. From way out.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I mean, Davos, man, for decades, has succeeded in putting off progressive taxation, antitrust enforcement, labor mobilization, by essentially saying, I've got this. We don't need impediments to innovation like labor unions and pencil-necked bureaucrats in Washington or Brussels or wherever telling us how to run our companies. You just leave it to me to run my company efficiently. I'll return profits to shareholders, and the benefits will trickle down to everyone. Something that has, in reality, happened zero times.
As the virtual World Economic Forum wraps up, we speak to New York Times correspondent Peter Goodman, author of the new book Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, then to Afghanistan.
There is no way to get out of Afghanistan after 20 years easily. Not possible, no matter when you did it. And I make no apologies for what I did.
As President Biden defends withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan, he ignores the devastating role U.S. sanctions are now playing in the country. We'll speak to The New Yorker's Jane Ferguson. Her latest piece, Afghanistan has become the world's largest humanitarian crisis. And we look at how the Biden administration was in court this week defending its use of Title 42, the Trump-era policy, which allows the U.S. to expel recently arrived migrants without due process. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva today. It was the highest-level negotiation between the U.S. and Russia since President Biden warned that a Russian invasion of Ukraine appears likely and that would prompt, quote, a severe and coordinated economic response. The U.S. says 100,000 Russian troops have amassed near the Ukrainian border. Russia denies it's planning an invasion but wants guarantees NATO will not expand to include Ukraine or any other former Soviet nations. Ahead of today's 90-minute meeting, Lavrov said he did not expect a breakthrough. Blinken also spoke before heading into the talks.
This is a critical moment. You're right. We don't expect to resolve our differences here today, but I do hope and expect that we can test whether the path of diplomacy, of dialogue, remains open.
As the U.S. continues to tout a diplomatic solution, Washington gave approval this week to three Baltic NATO members to send American-made arms to Ukraine. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has asked Ivanka Trump to voluntarily cooperate with its probe. The committee says Ivanka was present in the Oval Office when her father was trying to convince Vice President Mike Pence not to ratify results of the 2020 election. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has requested a special grand jury to probe whether Donald Trump or his allies committed a crime when they pressured Georgia election officials to overturn Joe Biden's win. In Washington, D.C., police arrested 28 nonviolent demonstrators Thursday after they held a sit-in protest outside the Capitol. Among those arrested was progressive New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman. The activists had been holding a hunger strike for democracy, demanding Senate passage of voting rights legislation. The measure appears doomed after conservative Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin rejected a change to Senate rules that would have allowed its passage with a simple majority. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell sparked outrage over comments he made to reporters Wednesday just before Republicans successfully filibustered voting rights legislation for the fifth time in 6 months.
What's your message for voters of color who are concerned that